This is VOA News via remote.
I'm Laurel Bowman. Myanmar's junta fired its United Nations ambassador Saturday for breaking ranks to denounce the military's ouster of civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi. And police stepped up a crackdown on protesters across the country. Myanmar has been shaken by a wave of demonstrations since a coup toppled civilian leader Suu Kyi on February 1st. Authorities have ramped up the use of force to suppress dissent, deploying tear gas, water cannon, and rubber bullets to disperse some protests. While in the streets, protesters chant, "What are the police doing? They are protecting a crazy dictator." In justifying its seizure of power, the military has alleged widespread fraud in the November elections, which Suu Kyi's party won in a landslide, and promised fresh polls in a year. But its ambassador to the United Nations on Friday broke ranks and made an emotional appeal to the international community for the strongest possible action to restore democracy. State-run TV announced Saturday night that he was no longer Myanmar's UN ambassador because he did not follow state orders. Myanmar State TV also broadcast the arrival of more than 1,000 Myanmar nationals deported from Malaysia, despite a court order halting the repatriation. The migrants, whom activists say include vulnerable asylum seekers, received a military welcome at Yangon's Navy port, attended by families and officials. Rights activists say some of the returnees include ethnic minorities who may have protection concerns. And Bangladesh's prime minister shrugged off criticism of her government's rights record as a second day of protests are held over the death of a writer in prison. This is VOA News. U.S. health advisors have endorsed a one-dose COVID-19 vaccine from Johnson & Johnson, readying America for what's being touted as an easier-to-use option to fight the pandemic. The acting head of the Food and Drug Administration said that the agency plans to move quickly to make J&J shot the third vaccine authorized for emergency use in the U.S. Vaccinations are picking up speed, but new supplies are urgently needed to stay ahead of a mutating virus that has killed more than 500,000 Americans. South Korea has begun a review of Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccine, the government said Saturday. The Food and Drug Ministry said it would study the one-shot vaccine with private advisory panels before it's authorized. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said it was closely following outbreaks of Ebola in Democratic Republic of Congo and Guinea, and said the risk of Ebola to the United States was extremely low. Out of an abundance of caution, the U.S. government will institute public health measures for the very small number of travelers arriving from the DRC and Guinea, the CDC said in a statement on Friday. A gorilla and two lions have tested positive for COVID-19 at the Prague Zoo, which is closed amid lockdown restrictions in the Czech Republic. The zoo director said on Facebook that the animals' symptoms have been mild so far. He said the lions have a cough and the gorilla has lost his appetite. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said Saturday that the country's biggest city, Auckland, will go into a seven-day lockdown from Sunday, after a new local case of the coronavirus and one of unknown origin had emerged. 2 weeks ago, Auckland's 2 million residents were ordered into a three-day lockdown when a family was diagnosed with the more transmissible UK variant of the new coronavirus that causes COVID-19. The U.S. House of Representatives has approved a $1.9 trillion pandemic relief bill in a win for President Joe Biden. But even as Democrats savor the major step, party leaders are trying to assure progressives that they'll revive their derailed drive to boost the minimum wage. The bill passed early Saturday on a near party line vote. It means cash for individuals, businesses, and states battered by COVID-19. It now heads to the U.S. Senate for hopeful passage. The U.S. Peace Corps turns 60 on Monday. It was established through an executive order by President Kennedy in 1961. It sent more than 240,000 young volunteers to 141 countries. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal, and our moderator is Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. With Joe Biden now in his second month as President of the United States, his foreign policy appears to be quite different from the policies and attitudes of Donald Trump. We'll explore what we're seeing so far. The Biden cabinet is taking shape, although at least one of the president's nominees was having trouble in the process that requires them to be confirmed by a majority of the U.S. Senate. And the coronavirus has now caused more than 500,000 deaths here in the United States, more than in any other country. Yet some parts of America have plans to reopen schools, some businesses, and entertainment such as sports events. The availability of new vaccines is clearly helping. But first, foreign policy. President Biden has a slogan. He says, America is back. He had his first summit with a foreign leader. That was Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. It was a virtual summit. They were connected by video link. Mr. Biden said the United States has no closer friend than Canada. And Prime Minister Trudeau was obviously criticizing the previous Trump policies when he said U.S. leadership has been sorely missed over the past years. And Trudeau also said it was nice to have an American government that's not removing every mention of climate change. Linda Feldman, can we take Trudeau as an example of foreign leaders, well, whose contempt for Trump, maybe that's too strong a word, is no longer a secret?
I don't know that contempt is too strong a word. I think you may recall that moment a couple of years ago when you had Justin Trudeau and a couple of other world leaders standing around. It was like the high school cafeteria talking about Donald Trump, it would appear. And yeah, they did not like the man. Much relief that he's off the world stage. But U.S.-Canada relations, it's not a complete easy street at this point. On his first day in office, Joe Biden decommissioned the Keystone XL pipeline, which was very important for Canadian energy purposes. So it's a new day in U.S.-Canada relations, but these things are never without complications.
As you say, foreign policy isn't just a matter of flipping a switch and changing, except for the slogan. America is back is so different from what Donald Trump had said, America first. Tom, what's your take? And just in general, you know, Donald Trump's still there, whether it's the policies of his 4 years or the fact that he wants to still be a major political figure. So Trump is not disappearing from the political scene, Tom.
Not yet, Dan, and he doesn't want to disappear from the political scene. He's gone from Washington. He's no longer president. His power has waned, but his power within the Republican Party has not waned. He is still the most dominant individual in that party, and he's making all kind of noises about running in 2024, which I personally believe will end up not happening, but he's trying to maintain his political appeal with tens of millions of Americans. Some of them are probably very happy he's gone, but many of them also believe, firmly believe, that the election was stolen from him, which is clearly not the case. So he's trying to stay relevant as best he can.
Linda, what do you make of Donald Trump's continued influence? I noticed that one of the few Republican critics of Trump in the U.S. Senate, Mitt Romney, says that if Trump competes for the party nomination to run for president in 2024, Trump would almost certainly win that nomination.
So that's how things might look now, but there is a lot of time to go. I mean, political predictions about 2024 made now must be taken with a grain of salt. And I agree with Tom. I think ultimately Trump will not run. I think he's sort of fanning this speculation that he will run because he loves the attention. He loves having influence over the party. He's lost his access to Twitter. So the times when he does appear in public and make public statements, like on Fox News, this just feeds Donald Trump like nothing else. But running again is a completely different matter. I mean, he'll be, by 2024, he'll be 4 years older. And he now knows, A, how hard it is to be president, or maybe he doesn't because he seemed to take a lot of executive time. It's just a lot of work. Running is a lot of work. And It may be that in a couple of years when the race gets serious, that there will be other Republicans on the stage who have captured some attention.
There are quite a few political pundits who expect that Donald Trump and his real estate company, maybe some members of his family, could face legal difficulties with even criminal investigations, say by the state of New York, and that could damage Trump, though some say in a way it could help him because his supporters would be so resentful. Tom, what should we think about the possibility that Donald Trump will have legal troubles?
Well, I don't think there's any question that he will have legal troubles, and he already has them. The Supreme Court has now, in recent days, said he, Trump, cannot shield his tax returns and his financial data from New York prosecutors. And that, I think, is the last word on that one. This information that Trump has fought from releasing for years and years will now have to be released and presented to a state grand jury in New York. Whatever happens from there remains to be seen. But he's got all sorts of legal challenges, some civil, some criminal, and he's going to have to spend a lot of time dealing with all of that. I think he is in some jeopardy. It's way too early to know just how vulnerable he is. I mean, some people say he's going to end up being in jail before it's all over. I doubt that, but there's no question he has a problem with the law in some fashion, and it's going to tie him up and complicate his life going forward.
Let's keep in mind that during his 4 years as president, Donald Trump was impeached twice by the House of Representatives. That's never happened to any other president. In both cases, there was a trial in the Senate, and there was not a two-thirds majority to convict President Trump. Let's talk about some more foreign policy changes. Whereas Trump had withdrawn from the United Nations Human Rights Council, the Biden administration says it wants to be back on that council, even though it is flawed, as the Biden administration puts it. Meantime, the Biden team decided to release to the public results of a U.S. investigation into the violent death of Jamal Khashoggi. You'll recall, a citizen of Saudi Arabia living in the United States, writing for an American newspaper. Khashoggi was a dissident lured to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, where he was murdered in 2018. It was understood that the CIA and other American agencies found that the killing was probably ordered by the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Saudi Arabia denies that. Donald Trump avoided blaming the Crown Prince. Now, Linda, I noticed one form of diplomatic punishment was that President Biden had a plan to phone the King of Saudi Arabia and apparently to protest the killing of Khashoggi. And the president pointedly would not speak with the Crown Prince, known as MBS. And in the background, Biden also is cutting off military aid to the war in Yemen, waged by Saudi Arabia and its Arab allies, who say they're fighting pro-Iran rebels in Yemen. Linda, is there a major break with Saudi Arabia?
I don't see a major break. Saudi Arabia, of course, is a key regional power. It's a check on Iran. So we can't lose the Saudis altogether. But the president's press secretary, Jen Psaki, made a point in a briefing of noting that the King of Saudi Arabia is the appropriate person for President Biden to speak with and not his son, the Crown Prince. This is a sharp break from how the Trump administration used to operate, where the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, used to have conversations with MBS. So this is yet another example of how the Biden White House is trying to kind of put things back on a normal diplomatic course.
A lot of people are wondering whether the Biden administration is trying to send out friendly feelers toward Iran, you know, by cooling things somewhat with Saudi Arabia. Of course, on the record, Secretary of State Tony Blinken has said that the U.S. wants to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal of 2015, the deal that Trump walked away from in 2018. Blinken says the U.S. wants to negotiate a better deal with stronger restrictions on Iran's nuclear work, and this time hoping also to limit development of new missiles. But Republicans in Congress and elsewhere in the U.S. say Biden and Blinken are soft on Iran, maybe even naive, and political conservatives warn that Iran will build nuclear weapons, that any new deal would expire in a few years. And Tom, when it comes to foreign policy, this Iran nuclear issue it is a pretty strong political issue in Washington.
I think there's no doubt about that, Dan. The Biden administration wants to engage or re-engage. Their attitude is talking is better than a military action. But Biden has said that he is not going to lift sanctions against Iran, period, until they agree to stop trying to produce nuclear weapons, nuclear bombs. That's a pretty hard red line there. So, again, I think basically the Biden people are saying, let's talk, but we're not going to give away the store, which the Republicans disagree with and think that Biden will give away the store. We will just see. I think this is one issue upon which Biden and the Democrats and the Republicans are just at total cross purposes. I mean, there's no middle ground politically, at least at the moment.
Linda, what are you hearing about the Iran issue? Secretary Blinken says publicly the U.S. is working with its European allies, Britain, Germany, and France on this, all of them part of the nuclear deal with Iran. But questions kept coming up at various briefings in Washington as to whether there are secret talks between the U.S. and Iran, which is what happened back in 2015, yes?
Exactly. So the issue of how the United States deals with countries with which it does not have formal relations always involves secret communications. I mean, you can not have a formal relationship, especially when it's a major country like Iran. We still have to deal with them. So the UN is an obvious venue for that. And one of the early, I think, goodwill gestures by the Biden administration after they took office was to lift the very restrictive rules that the Trump administration had put on the Iranian diplomatic mission in New York, giving them a lot more room to roam, let's say, in the New York area. But as you said, so far, there's no real breakthrough in the efforts to revive the Iran nuclear deal. The Iranians just, they want the sanctions lifted. The U.S. will not give up on that. And we're demanding that they come into full compliance with the accord. So as Tom says, we're really at an impasse.
We'll talk about Joe Biden's cabinet and how the Senate, made up of 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans, holds the key to confirming cabinet members or rejecting them after this brief break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and our moderator, Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Tom, as of the time that we're recording this program for VOA News, there's one nominee to the Biden cabinet who may fail to win confirmation by the United States Senate. Neera Tanden, for many years head of a liberal think tank in Washington, was nominated to be head of OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, a powerful job in the cabinet overseeing spending and government operations. Now, President Biden said he's firmly confident in Tanden, but Republicans and a few Democrats in the Senate said they don't like her style. On Twitter especially, she had harsh criticism, even personal insults aimed at Republicans, but also at progressive Democrats and Senator Bernie Sanders. So Tanden made some enemies. The Senate might not approve her for this job. And Tom, I guess it's fairly common with the start of a new administration that at least one nominee fails to win a confirmation vote. Tom?
That's right. I mean, it used to be, and it still is for the most part, that a new president is basically entitled to the people around him. He's entitled to name people he's comfortable with as his senior officials and senior and cabinet officers. In recent years, you're right, somebody usually bites the dust early on, and at the moment it might be Neera Tanden. I have to say, though, the hypocrisy of the Republicans is literally eye-rolling in this sense. Donald Trump did tens of thousands of what are being called by the Republicans these days about Tanden, mean tweets. Well, her tweets are just too mean. She treats Republicans poorly in her tweets. That wasn't a problem with Republicans when Donald Trump was tweeting tens of thousands of messages calling people stone cold losers, wackos, low IQ, low energy. That didn't seem to bother the Republicans, but Tandon's tweets bothered them a lot. The bottom line is this is probably not the wisest of Biden's appointments. You would think someone would say, well, we may have a problem with a nominee who's for a president who's preaching unity and bipartisanship, and she's spent a lot of time on her Twitter account trashing Republicans in very stark terms. At the moment, she's in trouble. And you know she's in trouble because a couple of days ago, the two committees of the Senate that have to approve her nomination postponed hearings. And usually when a hearing is postponed in this kind of a circumstance, it means the nominee, in this case Tandon, doesn't have the votes to win. The White House is desperate to find one Republican who will break with his or her party and vote for Tandon to save her. At the moment, she is imperiled, to put it mildly.
President Biden was pleased, on the other hand, by the outcome for a distinguished former U.S. diplomat, Linda Thomas Greenfield. She was confirmed by the Senate to be U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The vote was 78-20, important right now because for the whole month of March, the U.S. holds the presidency of the UN Security Council. And Linda Feldman, come in on this same subject. Biden gets almost all of his nominees confirmed by the Senate. It's quite right for Senate committees to have hearings and opponents to ask questions, but it's all part of the US system. There are nominees to be ambassador, to be cabinet officers, other government positions who don't just sail through.
Right. And in fact, this is by design. In the U.S. Constitution, under Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2, it calls for advice and consent, which is a reference to the Senate's role in approving or rejecting the appointments of top people, including cabinet members. Now, the exception to this is people who work with the president in the White House, which is a bow to the idea that the president should have whoever he wants literally at his side. But in terms of running cabinet agencies, that the Senate does have a say. And right now, the Senate is literally tied. It's 50-50 Democrat-Republican, with the Vice President Kamala Harris able to jump in and break a 50-50 tie. But this means that really President Biden really can't lose anybody on the Democratic side. And if he does, as he has done in the case of Neera Tandon, he has to lure in a Republican. I'm not sure it's going to work. In this case with Ms. Tandon, there's some thinking that she was almost put in there as a sacrificial lamb, as somebody who the Republicans can then shoot down. I'm not sure, you know, he thought that Joe Manchin in particular would reject her, given that it's possible, if not probable, that somebody more liberal than Neera Tandon would replace her if her nomination does fail.
Joe Manchin being a Democrat in the U.S. Senate, but representing a conservative state, West Virginia. Let's talk about the subject we hate to talk about. That's the worldwide pandemic, COVID-19. This past Wednesday, we heard something from international health officials that we rarely hear when it comes to COVID-19, that it was a day to celebrate. Because COVAX, led by the World Health Organization, aimed at reducing the gap between wealthy countries and poor ones, delivered vaccine doses to a developing country for the first time. The vaccines arrived in Ghana in West Africa. And Linda, the United States government is part of COVAX because while President Trump refused to join with his America First policy, President Biden has put the U.S. in COVAX. That implies a pledge to share some excess vaccine doses with countries that need them. Linda, especially on the health front, can you explain this change of attitude?
Well, the United States under Joe Biden very much wants to be a good citizen of the world. Donald Trump is all about America First, immunizing our people before anybody else, while Joe Biden definitely believes in getting as many Americans inoculated as quickly as possible. He also understands that we're the richest country in the world and that we can share and we can be generous with countries that are not as wealthy as we are. And so he immediately rejoined the United States into the World Health Organization, and COVAX is a part of that. The aim of COVAX is to reduce the gap between wealthy countries and the less wealthy. So this is good news for everybody because this virus doesn't know any international boundaries, for sure. So the faster we can get the entire world immunized, the better.
The number of deaths keeps rising. In fact, the total in the United States has now exceeded 500,000 people who've died because of COVID-19. President Biden and Vice President Harris led an official moment of silence to remember the victims. But there's hope in the form of the vaccines. For about 3 months in the U.S., two vaccines are being used, one made by Moderna, a fairly new American company. The other is made by the U.S. company Pfizer with a German company, BioNTech. And now a large American corporation, Johnson & Johnson, has received permission for its vaccine against COVID-19. Expecting emergency use to start just about right away. Tom, the Johnson & Johnson version is only one injection. You don't have to come back for a second shot. Tom, do you agree that will help a lot when it comes to people all around the world agreeing to get the shot?
Yes, I think it will help an awful lot, Dan. And it's not just the fact that it's one injection as opposed to two injections spaced from 3 to 4 weeks apart. The other thing that's important about Johnson & Johnson is you can store the vaccine in a refrigerator, a normal refrigerator, whereas the previous two vaccines have to be stored at super ultra below freezing temperatures, which made the logistics and the distribution of those vaccines trickier and slower. So the Johnson & Johnson version is a big step forward, and not just because of the numbers. There'll be hundreds of millions of more vaccine doses available. And, you know, everyone's the same. If you have the choice between two shots and one shot, everybody would just as soon have one shot. So I think kind of psychologically, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine will make it easier for some people who have been what's called vaccine deniers to get off the fence and say, well, maybe I should just take this vaccine, because it is important that everybody who can take this vaccine.
Investigations continue into the shocking events of January 6th, 2 weeks before President Trump left office, when thousands of his followers who felt he was cheated in the election invaded the Capitol building. At least five deaths are blamed on the clashes that day. Linda, when senators this past Wednesday had a hearing where they questioned some of the police officers who'd been taken by surprise, you might think about 9/11, the terrorist attack 20 years ago. That seemed to expose an intelligence failure. Linda?
It was absolutely shocking. I mean, we kind of suspected this was the case when you consider how woefully unprepared the security was at the Capitol when the extremists decided to invade. But we saw this at the hearing with now former chiefs of security for the Capitol basically couldn't agree on much of anything about what was happening when, who talked to whom when, requests for National Guard to be brought in. FBI intelligence reports had been submitted to the security forces, but that information either wasn't paid attention to or didn't make it up to the top commanders. So we're now in the process of setting up likely a commission, a nonpartisan independent commission, to study what happened, really along the lines of the 9/11 commission. I mean, this was in many ways another form of 9/11. Obviously, not nearly as many people died, but in some ways it was almost as shocking.
You know, during that hearing on the events of January 6th, one Republican senator, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, claimed that the invasion of the halls of Congress was not done by Trump supporters, but by leftists and anti-Trump people. Tom DeFrank, that's just one senator who's a Trump loyalist. But on the other hand, it does show how pro-Trump mythology persists.
Exactly right. I mean, Ron Johnson, who is up for re-election to the Senate in 2022, understands that he cannot break with Donald Trump. He recently, a couple of weeks ago, was quoted in an interview of saying voting against Trump on impeachment or other things would be suicidal for him and for other members of the Senate and the House Republicans as well. Trump still has a hold. He has a very strong hold on the apparatus of the Republican Party. Republican politicians are scared to death that if they cross Trump, he will find somebody to run against them in their primary races in 2022, and they're just scared to death about it. So I agree with Linda. I'll say again that I think at some point it'll be obvious that Trump's political power has begun to dissipate, but that is not now. He's still flying high within the Republican Party.
That's all the time we have for this broadcast as we look at American politics and so much more. Thanks to our panelists, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravitch.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Anna Mateo, and Dan Friedel. Later, Armin Kasabian answers a question from a learner in this week's Ask a Teacher. We close with an American story. This week, it is William Wilson, Part 2. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
China's decision to ban BBC World News from its television networks suggests increased government efforts to restrict foreign media. The ban took effect on February 11th. It was ordered shortly after the BBC produced a series of stories about ethnic Uyghur women in China's Xinjiang region. China's order also came after the British agency in charge of broadcasting canceled the official permission of China's CGTN news network to operate in Britain. British officials said the decision was linked to CGTN's ties to China's ruling Communist Party. In the series, the women reported abuse in government-run internment camps. More than a million people are estimated to be detained in such camps and in prisons across Xinjiang. The Chinese government has described the internment camps as job training centers and schools. It says the camps are necessary to fight Islamic extremism and a Uyghur separatist movement. But former camp detainees have repeatedly reported abusive treatment in the camps. China accused the BBC of reporting false news in its coverage of the internment camps. The government has also criticized BBC for reports about the COVID-19 pandemic in China. China's main broadcasting regulator or controller announced the ban in a statement. It accused the BBC of violating government rules about reporting on China. The news organization had, the statement read, failed to meet the requirements to broadcast in China as an overseas channel. Hu Xijin, editor of the Chinese government-run Global Times newspaper, tweeted that the reports were all false. He added that the BBC has become a bastion of the Western public opinion war against China. The action against the BBC adds to an increasingly difficult reporting environment in China. At least 17 journalists were expelled from China in 2020. the Foreign Correspondents Club of China said in a statement in September. Several had their media identifications canceled after the United States declared a number of Chinese media organizations in America as foreign missions. Sari Arohavren is a China expert based in Brussels. She says the Chinese government wants to establish a new world media order. With media in China already under strong control, the government is likely to make foreign media the next target, Havren told VOA. The BBC ban demonstrates how foreign media operating in China is increasingly treated as domestic media, meaning that the reporting from China that is not in line with the official party line will become increasingly sensitive and risky, Havren added. China's aim to restrict news covering sensitive issues within the country is nothing new. The government feels Western media unfairly targets and misrepresents local issues in the country. Government-run media or officials in China often describe such reports as fake news. The group Reporters Without Borders produces the World Press Freedom Index, a yearly report on 180 countries. It named China the third most restrictive country in terms of media freedoms. One Beijing-based foreign reporter told VOA that Chinese citizens are becoming less willing to speak with foreign media. He said 9 out of 10 locals cancel meetings planned with reporters. The reporter asked not to be identified, fearing he might be punished for his words. "Less and less people want to talk to us," he said, adding, "They are always afraid." I'm Brian Lin.
The London Zoo is one of the city's most visited places. During normal times, it is filled with visitors, both young and old. However, as the coronavirus crisis continues, the zoo is once again in lockdown, meaning no visitors at all. No one to watch. Silly monkeys play in trees. Dangerous king cobras sun on rocks. Or friendly penguins slide down slippery surfaces. Besides that, the lockdown is causing great economic harm. Every month, without visitors, costs the zoo about $1.4 million, Reuters news agency reports. So the future of the world's oldest scientific zoo is unclear. "We are losing so much money," zoo employee Kate Sanders told Reuters. "I'm concerned the zoo might not survive." Sanders is the team leader for big cats at the zoo. She added that having no visitors has been a really sad time for the zoo. Located in Regent's Park in central London, the London Zoo was opened in 1828 by the Zoological Society of London. Charles Darwin visited while writing his Origin of Species. Queen Elizabeth II is the zoo's patron. But famous connections will not be enough to keep the zoo open with no visitors.
The zoo has already faced millions of pounds in losses, and the latest lockdown is again keeping visitors away, even during the usually busy school holidays. The London Zoo was forced to close for 18 weeks in 2020, Reuters reported. That lockdown caused the zoo to lose £15 million. The latest lockdown is expected to cost another £1.8 million. The caretakers of the animals, the zookeepers, are sad and anxious. The Zoological Society of London also owns Whipsnade Zoo, located north of London. Together, the two zoos care for nearly 23,000 animals. All those animals need feeding and other kinds of care. So the number of zookeepers cannot be reduced any more than it has already. "We can't furlough animals," said Catherine England, chief operating officer of the London Zoo. "And you can't furlough all the staff who look after the animals. It just remains so sad that we are closed," she added. I'm Ana Mateo.
The United Nations Cultural Agency may consider the making of French bread, known as the baguette, for its list of intangible treasures. Bakers in France asked the French government to propose the traditional bread for the honor from UNESCO. About 6 million baguettes are sold every day in France. The French Minister of Culture will make a recommendation to UNESCO in March. The baguette is competing against two other candidates for France's nomination. The candidates are the metal rooftops of buildings in Paris made from zinc and a wine festival in the country's Jura area. In 2020, UNESCO considered things such as a dance in Zambia, camel racing in the United Arab Emirates, and pottery making in Serbia for its list of treasures. Bakers in France hope the baguette will be considered an official treasure because of its importance in French life. But the bakers also are worried the baguette is becoming less important in France. They say it is being replaced by frozen bread that gets produced in factories and sold in supermarkets. They want to protect small traditional bread makers. Many of the small bakeries had a difficult year in 2020 because of coronavirus restrictions. Since the 1950s, about 30,000 small bakeries closed in France as supermarkets became popular. Food and drink making methods in other countries are already considered treasures by UNESCO. The organization recognizes the making of flatbreads in Iran and Kazakhstan, Neapolitan pizza making in Italy, and beer making in Belgium. In 1993, the French government declared rules for bread to be considered a baguette. It must be made only from water, flour, yeast, and salt. The declaration noted the time and temperature for the uncooked bread to rise. I'm Dan Friedel.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Victor, who is from Brazil. Hello, my name is Victor. Can you talk about the use of the words security and safety? What's the difference between these two words? Best regards. Dear Victor, thank you for the email. While the words security and safety are nouns with similar meanings, they are used differently. Security often has to do with a group's efforts to protect its members from harm. Safety most often relates to a personal feeling of being free from harm or danger. Security seems to define efforts and measures that are outside of an individual, while safety is closer to an inner feeling. Here is a simple discussion to show the difference.
Did you think about safety when you moved to that neighborhood?
Yes, I did. Luckily, there is a security guard at the front door of the apartment.
In English, you may hear the word security used to describe people with the job of protecting a place. It is also used to describe efforts to protect the country.
The U.S. has the Department of Homeland Security so that its citizens can feel safe.
You may see some government buildings with high security measures to stop people from entering. Individuals, organizations, and governments value cybersecurity to stop people from causing harm to computers and equipment through the Internet. Here is one example.
Cybersecurity helps stop enemies from stealing private information.
We would not say cyber safety when talking about measures to protect the nation's computer systems. Cybersecurity, instead, describes the effort to stop others from attacking. Here's another example. In factories or workshops, workers need to wear face coverings or other protection, like safety glasses for their eyes. But such glasses are not called security glasses. That is because they relate to one's personal safety. They protect you from dangers like dust, viruses, flying objects, or chemicals.
I need to wear a face covering for my safety, to avoid breathing in these chemicals.
This person wants to be free from harm, so she used her safety mask. As a result, she follows job safety measures. Thank you again for the question, Victor. And to our listeners everywhere, what question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Armin Kasabian.
William Wilson, Part 2.
In the first part of my story, I spoke about my life at my first school and about the other boys, over whom I gained firm control. But there was one boy who would not follow my commands, who would not do what I told him to, as the other boys did. His name was the same as mine, William Wilson. Although he did not belong to my family in any way, he seemed to feel some love for me, and had entered the school the same day as I had. Many of the boys thought we were brothers. I soon discovered that we had been born on the same day, January 19th, 1809. Wilson continued his attempts to command me, while I continued my attempts to rule him. The strange thing is that, although I did not like him, I could not hate him. We had a battle nearly every day, it is true. In public it would seem that I had been proved the stronger. But he seemed somehow able to make me feel that this was not true, and that he himself was stronger. Nevertheless, we continued to talk to each other in a more or less friendly way. On a number of subjects we agreed very well. I sometimes thought that if we had met at another time and place, we might have become friends. It is not easy to explain my real feelings toward him. There was no love, and there was no fear, yet I saw something to honor in him. I wanted to learn more about him. Anyone experienced in human nature will not need to be told that Wilson and I were always together. This strange appearance of friendship, although we were not friends, caused no doubt the strangeness of battle between us. I tried to make the others laugh at him. I tried to give him pain while seeming to play a light-hearted game. My attempts were not always successful, even though my plans were well made. There was much about his character that simply could not be laughed at. I could find, indeed, but one weakness. Perhaps he had been born with it, or perhaps it had come from some illness. No one but me would have made any use of it against him. He was able to speak only in a very, very soft, low voice. This weakness I never failed to use in any way that was in my power. Wilson could fight back, and he did. There was one way he had of troubling me beyond measure. I had never liked my name. Too many other people had the same name. I would rather have had a name that was not so often heard. The word sickened me. When on the day I arrived at the school, a second William Wilson came also, I felt angry with him for having the name. I knew I would have to hear the name each day a double number of times. The other William Wilson would always be near. The other boys often thought that my actions and my belongings were his, and his were mine. My anger grew stronger with every happening that showed that William Wilson and I were alike in body or in mind. I had not then discovered the surprising fact that we were of the same age, but I saw that we were of the same height. And I saw that in form and in face we were also much the same. Nothing could trouble me more deeply, although I carefully tried to keep everyone from seeing it, than to hear anyone say anything about the likeness between us of mind or of body or of anything else. But in truth I had no reason to believe that this likeness was ever noticed by our schoolfellows. He saw it, and as clearly as I, that I knew well. He discovered that in this likeness he could always find a way of troubling me. This proved the more than usual sharpness of his mind. His method, which was to increase the likeness between us, lay both in words and in actions, and he followed his plan very well indeed. It was easy enough to have clothes like mine. He easily learned to walk and move as I did, His voice, of course, could not be as loud as mine, but he made his manner of speaking the same. Ah, how greatly this most careful picture of myself troubled me, I will not now attempt to tell. It seemed that I was the only one who noticed it. I was the only one who saw Wilson's strange and knowing smiles, pleased with having produced in my heart the desired result. He seemed to laugh within himself and cared nothing that no one laughed with him. I have already spoken of how he seemed to think he was better and wiser than I. He would try to guide me. He would often try to stop me from doing things I had planned. He would tell me what I should and should not do, and he would do this not openly, but in a word or two in which I had to look for the meaning. As I grew older, I wanted less and less to listen to him. As it was, I could not be happy under his eyes that always watched me. Every day I showed more and more openly that I did not want to listen to anything he told me. I have said that in the first years when we were in school together, my feelings might easily have been turned to friendship. But in the later months, although he talked to me less often then, I almost hated him. Yet let me be fair to him. I can remember no time when what he told me was not wiser than would be expected from one of his years. His sense of what was good or bad was sharper than my own. I might today be a better and happier man if I had more often done what he said. It was about the same period, if I remember rightly, that by chance he acted more openly than usual, and I discovered in his manner something that deeply interested me. Somehow he brought to mind pictures of my earliest years. I remembered, it seemed, things I could not have remembered. These pictures were wild, half-lighted, and not clear, but I felt that very long ago I must have known this person standing before me. This idea, however, passed as quickly as it had come. It was on this same day that I had my last meeting at the school with this other strange William Wilson. That night, when everyone was sleeping, I got out of bed, and with a light in my hand, I went quietly through the house to Wilson's room. I had long been thinking of another of those plans to hurt him, with which I had until then had little success. It was my purpose now to begin to act according to this new plan. Having reached his room, I entered without a sound. Leaving the light outside, I advanced a step and listened. He was asleep. I turned and took the light and again went to the bed. I looked down upon his face. The coldness of ice filled my whole body. My knees trembled, my whole spirit was filled with horror. I moved the light nearer to his face. Was this the face of William Wilson? I saw, indeed, that it was. But I trembled as if with sickness as I imagined that it was not. What was there in his face to trouble me so? I looked and my mind seemed to turn in circles in the rush of my thoughts. It was not like this, surely not like this, that he appeared in the daytime. The same name, the same body, the same day that we came to school. And then there was his use of my way of walking, my manner of speaking. Was it in truth humanly possible that what I now saw was the result, and the result only, of his continued efforts to be like me? Filled with wonder and fear, cold and trembling, I put out the light. In the quiet darkness I went from his room, and without waiting 1 minute, I left that old school and never entered it again.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.